Everyone, for joining us for today's ISRM Portfolio Directors Panel discussion. And I would like to turn things over to Dr. Chris Bever.
So good morning, everybody. Thank you, Heidi, for setting things up. So for those of you who don't know me, I'm the director, the Deputy Chief Research and Development Officer for Investigator Scientific Review and Management, which basically oversees what used to be the services and is now, as I'll describe in the talk, portfolios, broad portfolios, and actively managed portfolios. So I've done two webinars in the last couple of months. So the slides that I'm using today are derived from that webinar. It's slightly shorter. It's basically just to set the stage. We would like to retain most of the time for questions and answers, again, because of the number of people involved. If you can put your questions into the Q&A, then Heidi will send them to us to answer. So now let me see if I can advance the slides. There. So I'd like to welcome and thank our panel members today. The first one is Patricia Dorn, who's the Executive Director of Rehabilitation, R&D, and Translation. The next is Amy Kilbourn, the Executive Director of L-Systems Research. Holly Krall is next. She's the Acting Executive Director of the Medical Health Research Broad Portfolio. Next is Ken Myrie, the Director of the Precision Oncology Actively Managed Portfolio. Then we have Miriam Smith, the Acting Executive Director for Brain Behavioral and Mental Health Research. And just to point out, Ken Myrie is an actively managed portfolio. There are actually five of those. We limited the panel to the people shown here. So we have the four broad portfolio leads as well as one of the actively managed portfolio leads. And then I will serve as moderator, shown at the bottom there. So we're just preparing to celebrate the 100th year anniversary of the Office of Research and Development. It is next year. And as many of you know, I think we have a very strong record of accomplishments. We funded the first randomized controlled clinical trial. We funded the development of the cardiac pacemaker. We funded the first liver transplant or research leading up to that. In the rehab realm, the Seattle foot and the DECA arm. And we have supported multiple Nobel laureates. So we're now in the process of preparing VA research for the next 100 years. So organizing research funding around areas of veteran need. We're adopting a shared governance model in ORD. We're adopting the NIH approach using notices of funding opportunities, and then harmonizing our processes across the portfolios. So the way we were organized previously, we had services that were organized around research disciplines, and they're shown in the middle of this slide here. And areas of veteran need, which are just shown arbitrarily here as A, B, and C, were split up. So for example, traumatic brain injury, there were programs in each of the portfolios, and that was true for many other areas. What we're now organized under is a new structure with shared governance. So you see a series of boxes or rectangles across the slide here. On the left in lighter blue, actively managed portfolios, and on the right in darker blue, broad portfolios. And I already mentioned the four broad portfolios in introducing the directors of those. The actively managed portfolios, I introduced Ken Myrie, who you'll see the Precision Oncology brought actively managed portfolio in the middle of the slide. And then you'll see additional ones, military exposures, pain and opioid use, suicide prevention, and traumatic brain injury. As it says here, the actively managed portfolios are focused on, and they develop a roadmap and are focused on translational goals. The broad portfolios cover a broader range of research, including a lot of investigator-initiated research. The current state is these nine portfolios, and we're trying to have a more agile organization, so there could be additional portfolios added, or if need for particular portfolios goes away, that they would remove. And governance is through the ISRM Leadership Council, which is shown in green on this slide, and I'll talk about it a little bit more further on. Each of the portfolios has representation on the ISRM Leadership Council. So the scientific review groups that you are familiar with are not changing in their purview or their discipline focus, but some of them are moving within the broad portfolios. So you'll see several that are highlighted in yellow here. So you'll see that in HSR, or Scientific Review Group on Mental and Behavioral Health, has moved into the Brain Behavior Mental Health broad portfolio, and then two panels that were originally in rehab are moving into this broad portfolio. Again, the purpose here is not to change the character of those committees. We need rehabilitation in BBMH. We need health systems research in BBMH. So the purpose here is to bring them in alignment with other review groups that are working in similar areas. And the same for ONC, A, B, C, D. There were some panels that used to be organized under the old CSRD service that have been moved into medical health. The cadence of meeting of the different scientific review groups will also not change. So the ones that are blue here are winter, summer, and the ones that are green are spring and fall. And so you'll see that even within one broad portfolio, there will be some panels that will be meeting in one cycle and then other panels that will be meeting in the other cycle. So for investigators, it's going to be important for them to identify which scientific review group they want and then to request that when they put in their pre-application so that they get the committee that they want to be reviewed by and that there are no delays in waiting for that committee to meet. So I mentioned shared governance before and the ISRM Leadership Council. So this is made up of the leadership of ISRM, as well as the directors of each of the portfolios. It provides oversight of portfolio activities, promotes cross-portfolio communication, collaboration, and it also provides a conduit for communication up to ORD leadership. The funding process is that the budget for each portfolio is determined by the Leadership Council at the beginning of each fiscal year, and that's determined from the value of the projects from the end of the prior fiscal year, plus any additional funding that was provided within the budget for that particular portfolio. And for example, the OMB budget has provided additional funding for areas like precision oncology and traumatic brain injury. The Leadership Council does have authority to transfer funds between portfolios during the fiscal year if there's a need to do that. So for project funding, applications for funding will be reviewed in either a standing scientific review group or for special solicitations, a special review group. Each of the portfolios will hold a funding ranking meeting for each cycle. where the projects that were reviewed that fit within its purview will be reviewed. And the portfolios will produce a ranked list of funding recommendations. So based on the budget that they have, they will project what they can afford to support. And then that list will go to for approval to the ISRM Leadership Council. So the NIH, I think about 10 years ago, shifted to notices of funding opportunities where they had more parent type RFAs and then notices of special interest to indicate areas where they were interested in having investigators submit applications. So we've moved to that approach. So you'll see here on the left, RFAs for career development, research career scientists, pilot research, research including a clinical trial and research not including a clinical trial, and then center cores. And there's a corresponding pre-application for each of the RFAs shown on the right here. So the notices of special interest are shown here. On the left are the ones that are based on portfolio purviews. So you'll see one for each of the broad portfolios, and then one for each of the actively managed portfolios, plus Gulf War at the bottom. And then on the right are some cross-cutting notices of special interest, so women's health and some others there. And it's important to note that the ones on the right are not funded portfolios. And so researchers can indicate an interest, for instance, in women's health, but they also need to link to one of the notices of special interest or a broad portfolio. So one on the left as well. So we're working to harmonize processes across the portfolios. So you'll see here the calendar for submission applications. And I'm not going to go through this in detail. It's been distributed earlier with the webinars, and this slide set will be sent to you at the end of the presentation. This is a more detailed, just outlining what the pathway is in, right now for career development, research, including a clinical trial, and tech transfer, versus on the right, RCSs, pilot awards, and research not including a clinical trial, giving you the critical dates in the submission process. We've tried to harmonize our budgets. So this goes through the budget caps and durations for research, including an interventional clinical trial. And again, you'll get this, so you can go through the details if you want. For research not including a clinical trial, there's a limit of up to 3 merit awards for any one PI. Non-clinician PI salary, you can add 3/8 above the cap. Any additional salary requirements must be taken from the research award itself. And the cap on that is $200,000 per year, up to 4 years. There is a waiver process if the budget cap is insufficient for the required research. These two slides on what has changed and what has not changed, I've shared earlier. I'm not going to go through all the points here, but they will be distributed to you. So in conclusion, at the beginning of this month, we transitioned from the 4 services to 9 portfolios. Service RFAs have been replaced by cross-portfolio RFAs and notices of special interest. The peer review panels remain the same, and portfolio funding recommendations will be reviewed by the ISRM Leadership Council, which has representation from all of the portfolios. So we're approaching the 100-year anniversary, and so it's a good time to try to reposition the research program to align with current challenges and requirements. So we've adopted a new organizational structure built around veteran needs and designed to improve the health and to improve health system performance. And I would add that although we're built around areas of veteran need, that does not mean that we're reducing our support for the disciplines that conduct the research. Obviously, investigators are critical to the success of our program, and supporting the disciplines that do the research remains a high priority. New processes have been implemented to accelerate innovation, speed implementation, and rapidly respond to changing requirements from Congress and other important stakeholders. So I think that's the end of my presentation. If we can unshare, Heidi, and then I think you're going to shift to a screen that has all of us, the panel.
Yep, give me just a second and I will get everyone moved to the stage.
And I saw as I was presenting that there were questions that were being added to the chat. So once Heidi gets us all populated on the screen, then maybe she can go back to that and forward questions to us.
So our first question, if you guys want to start discussing this, the SF-424 has still not been updated. People are wondering when that will be available.
So I'd have to go in back and check. Either the SF-424 was felt to be usable for the current round, or I thought that it had actually been updated, and could it be a problem of refreshing your whatever it is that you're still pulling things up? Can any of the other portfolio directors comment on that? We may have to take that offline then to check. Thank you for raising the issue though.
Yeah, but they said the website is still showing the April 2022 version with a note that it will be updated. We've gotten many questions about that, so that is definitely the biggest thing going on out here right now. Okay, next question here. Can the panel please let us know what is needed for resubmission LOIs for the pre-applications? We have heard that resubmissions need LOIs, but the RFA states a cover page and updated bio sketch for a resubmission that is unchanged. Which is it?
Somebody want to comment on that?
So, Chris, this is Holly. I will start. So each application requires a pre-application. So and LOI is, you know, what we have asked for in the past. So in order to submit an application, you will be submitting a pre-application. And that pre-application for a resubmission can be an updated bio sketch and a cover page, as long as the changes are not significant.
Thank you, Holly.
Great, thank you. Next question here. In planning a grant, we found a problem when a project arguably fit in two actively managed portfolios. One AMP manager agreed our study fit well, but indicated why in fact that AMP will probably have less money to allocate based on its spending plan. She urged us to discuss our application with a different AMP where we might also fit, mainly because they anticipated more money in the other AMP. If investigators need to game their application against funding by protocol, will you publish this information?
Yeah, so we should be able to publish the AMP budgets. I guess it's a little bit complicated in the sense that you know, the available money for new projects doesn't just depend on the budget of the AMP. It also depends on how many projects will be ending during the period in question. So I'm surprised that an AMP leader was able to project that out, because basically what you're talking about, if you submitted the application now, the funding wouldn't be in a position to be funded probably for a year. But maybe one of the other directors would like to speak to that issue of how you game the system. Amy?
Sure. We've talked a lot about this because in health systems research in our broad portfolio, we cover a very broad array of topics, including the same topics as the AMPs, but with a focus on learning health system methods, right? So what we've encouraged our investigators to do is look at the notices of special interest. And if you have a particular interest or you're working in an area that's also covered by an AMP, but also covered by a broad portfolio, basically pick the one that is closest to what essentially is resonating with what's said in the NOSI, but also just keep in mind that we will pay attention to things that are what we call twofers. You know, we are looking for innovative science that's covered by the broad portfolio, as well as innovative areas of high priority that's covered by the AMPs.
That is correct, Amy, and I associate with that because I was thinking about the same thing, in that it is not uncommon for you to be working on something that may have an overlap with another area. And as Amy pointed out, sometimes it's important that you pay attention to the NOSI and the sometimes the priority areas that are in the NOSIs, particularly for the AMPs, to see if your proposal or your thoughts or whatever it is you're proposing to do best fit the AMP versus the broad portfolio.
Yeah, and again, Ken is speaking as an AMP director. I would say generally the AMPs have smaller budgets than the broad portfolios, so there may be slight different issues there. Any other comments before we go on to the next question? Heidi?
With the move of HSR and RRD review panels to the BBMH portfolio, will non-clinicians whose work best fits there have to now apply for non-clinician eligibility?
Oh, so thank you for asking that question. I did not address that in the talk that I had, but it's a very important issue. And that is, the eligibility issues go with the cycle, not with the portfolio. So basically, the eligibility limitation has to do with, Holly, am I right, spring and fall, that the cycle, the old BLRD-CSRD cycle. So the panels that used to be in BLRD and CSRD have those eligibility restrictions on them, whereas the winter-summer cycles do not. So those panels that moved are going to continue in their old cycle, so they would not be affected by those eligibility limitations.
Thank you. Next question here. I note that suicide is sitting in a health service research review panel, but doesn't that basically bias the review and award of future suicide research toward the applications that use HSR language and concepts, and against those that approach suicide with other methods and understandings?
So, Amy, you want to address that?
Sure. I'll have to look at the NOSIs again, but the two notices of special interest for suicide prevention appeared, in, from my perspective, to be pretty cross-translational. Now, in general, a lot of work that's been done in suicide prevention has been population-based, has been using what we call foundational learning health system methods, which is why I think a lot of the same concepts overlap between the NOSIs and HSR and the NOSIs for the suicide prevention research. Having said that, I think you bring up an important point that I think what we're trying to do in this reorganization is to break down not just the organizational silos, but the language silos, and make sure that when we talk about a health outcome or a goal that's veteran-centric, that we're not just using jargon that, you know, we probably to our own fault in health systems research, you know, probably use too much of. So I think in general, one of the things to think about is look at the study section or the scientific merit review board that you're hoping to submit your proposal to, and really get a sense of the areas of expertise, and then think about not like pandering to that group, obviously, but just really think about how your science can be written in a way that's generalizable across the translation spectrum for different audiences to understand.
Great, thank you.
Anybody else want to comment on that? I think in some ways everybody has a little piece of that, but it did at the beginning of the question say something about health services. So that's why I picked on Amy. And Joe Constance is not here. He's the director of the Suicide Prevention AMP, so he's not available on the call to.
And I also think that in general principle, irrespective of what panel someone sends an application to, the program managers really do a really good job of trying to recruit individuals that they feel will give your application a fair review. So we always try to make sure we have experts to cover down on the applications that are in the panels. And so while the panel may be broad, we try to target some of the expertise that are recruited for the panels to cover many of the applications that are there.
Thank you, Ken. Any other comments? All right, if not, Heidi?
Which review group will review multiple sclerosis?
Oh, gosh, I've answered that question multiple times, and I still don't remember the answer. It's one of the neuro panels, but does anybody remember that?
NeurB?
NeurB?
And RRD4, or A, sorry. Miriam, is that right? Sorry.
So that said, you know, multiple sclerosis is mentioned in the BBMH broad NOCI. So really, we would need to know more. We would need to know the aims of the study, the outcome measures, and so on. So I would suggest reaching out to one of the scientific portfolio managers to discuss those kinds of details.
Thanks.
Next question here. Can you speak to the justification for structuring the grant cycle so that applicants do not receive scores for their grants before pre-applications are due for the next cycle? How are PIs supposed to be responsive to reviewers if they don't have their comments?
So I think that mainly applies to career development, research, including a clinical trial, and the technology development, which have an earlier deadline for their pre-applications. And the reason for the earlier deadline was because we would like to provide more support at the pre-application stage for those applications. It's demoralizing for investigators to have their proposals, you know, either administratively sent back or triaged in review. It just uses up a cycle. And so we do have staff who look at clinical trials to try to provide support early on. And we have staff who look at career development applications, particularly the CDA early stage ones, trying to give them guidance so that they can put in better applications. So I think on resubmissions of those awards, people are just going to have to say in the pre-application that they didn't have the comments or scores from the prior review. And there's no expectation then that the pre-application would address the comments that had been generated in the prior review, but they would be expected to be addressed in the full application. So that's how we ended up with that. I understand that it's awkward for the field to deal with that. But that's how it should be handled. Any comments from any of the directors?
Well, and I think Holly mentioned earlier that with the resubmission, you're simply looking for the cover page, the biostatistical sketch, even though you don't have your summary statement, the resubmission pre-application would be minimal for submission.
Thanks, Ken. Any other comments? Okay, if not, Heidi, next.
Next question, harmonized budget limits appear to be higher than the limit laid out under some NOCES, i.e. 300,000 per year versus 200,000 per year, the latter being the limit on the suicide NOCE. It's confusing, although it also implies less funding will be allowed for suicide research.
So yeah, the RFAs are what determine the budget limits. The NOCES don't determine the budget limits. So the governing document is the RFA. So again, the 200,000 cap that we had for research not involving a clinical trial was trying to harmonize. We had services with higher budget caps and lower budget caps, and that was chosen to try to be in the middle. Again, if the research can't be done within the cap and there's good justification for a waiver, then the applicant should put in a waiver request in the pre-application stage. Any comments from any of the directors?
Yeah, this is Amy. I'd also add too that the limit for clinical trials has gone up, and especially if you have more than one site. Also for non-clinical trials, there's the 3/8 support for a non-clinician investigator as well. One thing to think about too, and this relates to, I think, a lot of our priority areas, is that a lot can be leveraged with existing resources that are already paid for or provided through our ORD-funded centers, as well as our operational partners. And for example, there's a ton of national data on suicide prevention and sites that are implementing suicide prevention programs through HSR Query, for example. There's also the Office of Mental Health, Suicide Prevention Office as well. So there's a lot of infrastructure, what I would call like a level of maturity in the learning healthcare system for some of these areas more than others, which is why that we're encouraging investigators to leverage these existing resources to really do that important embedded research that needs to be done.
Thanks. Any other comments? Heidi?
How is the budget cap handled for non-clinical PIs for proposals with multiple PIs? Are 3/8 of each MPI salary outside of the budget cap?
Oh, thank you for asking that. No, the 3/8 would only apply to one of the PIs. If additional salary support is required for the second PI, then that would all have to come out from underneath the cap.
Thank you. Next question here. What happened to the collaborative merit mechanism? It's not represented as an RFA any longer.
So I don't believe that we've made a final decision on that. In the rush to get the RFAs up, that was not one that got posted. But I don't know, Holly, have we had a discussion at the ISRM Leadership Council of resurrecting that?
So we've had initial discussions because I think that is a mechanism that has grown in popularity and matured into a really productive set of applications that have come in. We would like to continue the collaborative merits. We are just in the process of developing the RFA so that the various portfolios can sign on to them with their notice of special interest. But because that has been a typical BL and CS type of application, we are going to pause receiving new applications for the current round But put that, try and get the RFA up for the next set of submission applications.
And any other comments from any of the other directors on that? I'll just make a editorial comment that, you know, in a normal round, we would not be sunsetting and replacing all our RFAs. So you can imagine that there was a tremendous amount of work that had to be done, because that's essentially what we did for October 1st. And so I just want to give a shout out to Christy Benton Grover, Tiffin Ross Shepherd, and Mike Bergio, who were burning the midnight oil to make sure we got all the essential RFAs up. They did a tremendous amount of work at the last minute. And they all deserve a big pat on the back if you happen to see them or what they've done. All right, Heidi.
So we have a couple more questions here about the resubmission pre-application deadlines. If I do not receive my score or summary statements before the pre-application is due, then I cannot change my number of sites or other budget issues in response to reviewers. Is your advice simply to push off resubmission because of this pre-application issue?
Well, because of the, we've created the difficulty on pre-applications. So if it turned out that in when you got the reviews that they were telling you to increase the number of sites or make some other significant change to the design, which had a big impact, I would talk to your portfolio manager about that. And I think that we would be in a position to have to find some way of supporting that. Let me open it up and ask if any of the directors have. Trisha, you
have a comment? I do have a comment. Right. Hi, everybody. My comment is the following, that I would recommend in a pre-application that you bring forward for a potential resubmission you would need to make because you wouldn't have been selected for funding that cycle, is that you indicate in there that when you receive the summary statement with the individual critiques, that you will incorporate that into the resubmission and indicate if that may include changes to number of sites and other things like that. And I would just put that in there as a statement and an acknowledgement of what you need to do and what you don't have the information in front of you to do right now. And again, always continue to recommend that you do reach out and speak to the scientific program managers. These people are here for you, to guide you, to talk to you, as are we. And please continue to carry on with that practice, or if you haven't been, to take up that practice. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Any other comments? Heidi?
How do we know whether to apply to Precision Oncology or MedHealth?
Ken. You're muted.
Ken, we can't hear you.
So I that's a question I get very fairly often. And so in precision oncology, we are really focused about using precision approaches to addressing various issues in oncology. And so the simple line I would say is that if you're not taking a precision approach, meaning that you are utilizing certain characteristics of a patient, their tumor, molecular tumor profiles, biomarker issues or things of that nature, to make it an individualized approach to the problems you're trying to solve, then it belongs in medical health.
Holly, do you want to comment?
I think Ken did a great job.
and I want to assure the community that when we receive your pre-application, we will, do due diligence to ensure that it is placed in the right portfolio for you to come forward with your study. The other thing that I will also take the opportunity to mention is that in precision oncology, we are really looking for those team-based approach, multidisciplinary approach activities to help us accelerate things towards the clinic and or to inform decision-making, but again, the policy level or the level of the clinician.
Thank you. Any other comments? Heidi?
On the ISRM SRG purview document in the RRD1 section, it includes this statement: prior approval is required for the use of transgenic models. However, it doesn't provide the pathway to submit that request.
That was RRD1?
RRD1, Trisha? Yes.
Trisha, can you comment on that?
Okay, so for that, I recommend if that is a research avenue that you are seeking to take on, then I would first tell you to reach out to that scientific program manager to discuss that. And I would say at this moment, it represents a less formal and more informal interaction, but we can get that more codified. So I would tell you to start with the SPM.
Is that Audrey Kusiak?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, next question here. Will cross-portfolio opportunities exist? For example, hospital management of HAI could include basic science elements to better understand microbial contribution to environmental persistence. We'll also have hospital systems aspects for implementation.
Somebody want to take that on? Amy, you're smiling. Do you want to try to address that? That's
good. Music to my ears. I love these kinds of questions. Yes, we're striving to be cross-translational. And now in terms of focusing, right, to get the project funded, the general rubric we've been using, and my colleagues here can disagree or tell me otherwise, but one, at least in HSR, the way we've defined it as, what is your primary aim? What is what your primary hypothesis is, and what is your study primarily powered to do? And if that question that you're trying to answer is essentially anything patient level or down to the cell, molecular level, then it's likely not an HSR topic. If the question, your primary aim hypothesis is about anything at the patient above to the organization level, it's primarily health systems research. So, I mean, I know that's kind of maybe in platitudes, but basically, generally speaking, it really depends on what your study is primarily designed to do and what your primary hypothesis is all about in terms of, power calculations. Now, having said that, we are welcoming, and I'm hoping that, my colleagues here would welcome a secondary aim that's focused on an implementation question. This is exactly what we're trying to do with the hybrid designs. But at the same time, you need to kind of orient the study to what it's designed to do and orient it to the portfolio that best matches what your study is designed to do. Your secondary exploratory aims, they can be about implementation processes and things like that, but they really are not, again, the main point of your study. You're not powering your study based on those secondary aims. So those would be, again, considered secondary to maybe a more kind of an efficacy focus or biomedical focused aim.
Well stated, Amy, and I think that you can be assured that we will be discussing across our portfolios when we see things that falls into or has potential to cross two different buckets, right? We get that, for example, in precision oncology and military exposure, for example. And so the two directors discussed where we feel that application should reside, and we make those decisions and inform you, knowing that we are trying to make the best decision and give you the best opportunity for funding. Nonetheless, as Amy said, you should really focus the application based on the primary outcomes and aims so that it fits into the right bucket.
Any other thoughts on that? Not Heidi?
For resubmissions of CDA awards, are we adhering to the prior budget cap or the new budget in the NOSI?
Oh, so thank you for asking that question. So basically, if we already reviewed a proposal, then it can come back in with whatever the requirements were on the original submission. But you will have to put in, when you put in the pre-application, you need to have to submit the waiver saying this is a resubmission, it was accepted with this budget cap, and so we're asking that you allow that. And we're trying to be accommodating of things that were reviewed prior to the transition over. Does anybody want to comment on that? Not seeing anything. Thanks. Heidi?
Why do the winter and summer cycles not have eligibility requirements? I thought the reorganization was to equalize things across the board.
Yes, so good point. We are trying to harmonize our processes across all of the program. We just ran into some practical issues of managing the workload and the funding rates. So basically, in the cycles that have the restrictions on them, if we don't have those restrictions, we get many more applications and we're not staffed internally to review them, and there's no more money to fund them, so then the funding rate for everybody drops down into the single digits. So this is not desirable or a good long-term solution to the problem, but it's what we've had to do in the short run in order to manage those issues. I don't know, Holly, do you want to comment at all on that? Or Miriam, you're both that cycle.
So I really don't have anything more to add. I think you summarized what the major issues are. When we have tried to open up the cycle for BLR&D in the past, we have received hundreds of applications more than we normally receive. And, I think, like Chris says, we really are trying to manage our success rates for that would be appropriate for an intramural program, as well as, making sure that applications get a fair and unbiased review.
Yeah, good point, Holly. And we are an intramural program. We're not like the NIH. And so I think having some processes in place to maintain the intramural nature of the program is appropriate. So, thank you for the question, Heidi.
In selecting a scientific review group, one SRG best fits the methods in my plan study, a different SRG best fits the topic. In this situation, which do I prioritize when selecting an SRG?
My advice would be to talk to the portfolio managers on the two different scientific review groups, but let me open it up, see if any of the directors would want to add to that.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Chris. It really is important for the field to reach out to the SPMs. The SPMs will work together to find the best home for your submission.
Thanks, Miriam. Anything else? Thank you. Heidi?
Do you support basic science PIs to apply grants in two different portfolios if proper justification, expertise, and rationale are demonstrated?
So there is a limitation. I'm not sure whether they're talking about ever or within one cycle. So there is a limitation of one application per RFA per cycle, but any given PI is allowed to have up to three merit awards. So, you know, if they're capable of writing multiple excellent proposals, then they should go for it. Let me open it up. Ken, you're smiling. What are you?
I think the optimum word there is excellent, right?
Yeah, having struggled myself to write one excellent proposal, I'm in awe of anybody who can write multiple excellent proposals. But any other comments? All right, if not, thank you. And Heidi?
Who would be the best review group, and or will there be no Cs for CD applications for aging topics that are not related to dementia? Things like caregiver support, geriatric workforce, polypharmacy, and deprescribing.
Those sound like Amy, Health Systems. Amy, you want to comment on that?
Absolutely, yes. I think those are areas about the healthcare system and its impact on the aging veteran population. And as an aside, HSR, with our colleagues across ISRM, are planning a state-of-the-art conference on the age-friendly health system. So strongly encourage you to look at what's already been funded in aging and health systems research, our Caregiver Center of Excellence, and our SAGE query program as well, to look at just essentially the lay of the land.
So one of the issues we had to contend with in the redesign of the organization was how do we handle aging? And each of the services had an aging program, and there was a thought of, should we have an aging AMP or an aging broad portfolio? But again, aging should be a consideration in every portfolio that we have. Obviously, for precision oncology, aging is going to be an issue. For TBI, it's an issue. Every portfolio should be concerned about aging issues. And again, since it just across the whole organization, we have a way of trying to capture that, which we've also used for women's health, and that is having a work group that works across the portfolios. Women's health already has a NOSI out there, and we have an aging work group that Holly is organizing that will also be putting out a NOSI. So aging is a very important research area for us. It touches a high percentage of our veteran population because of the age distribution. And if you look at projects which involve aging issues, it's, I think, slightly over 50% of everything that we're currently funding. So it's a really big part of the program. So Amy addressed that, but Dr. Dorn has an aging portfolio in her broad portfolio, or an aging SRG in her broad portfolio. And as was mentioned in the question, brain behavioral health and mental health has a SRG on aging issues, neurodegenerative issues. And then there are a number of panels in medical health that have significant aging components, and there's one panel, frailty and Jero's aging issues or something, Holly. There is one panel that is focused on aging issues specifically. Did I get it right, or correct me if I got it wrong?
So I would say yes. So our CAM panel has, our cell and molecular medicine panel has a lot of geroscience type of research that is on there. And endocrinology B, which looks at bone and muscle, has some frailty components as well.
Thank you. Any other comments on aging? Not Heidi?
Unfortunately, the 18-week pre-application cycle for CDAs removes the winter application cycle for most postdoctoral fellows who typically begin their training year during the month of August, given pre-app due date of 8/1. Do the panelists have any guidance on whether a fellow who will be starting but has not yet finished a clinical internship or joined VA might be able to submit a pre-application prior to onboarding in order to submit for the winter cycle?
So it's my experience that we do receive CDA applications from individuals prior to completing their clinical fellowship because they want to be prepared to have a transition into the CDA when they come on board VA. Sometimes they have already completed their paperwork for onboarding and things of that nature, and they're just finished up their clinical fellowship and they want to have plans about when they would like to start. Knowing that the CDA process is very competitive, they do try to put those applications in early so that they can be prepared for transitioning into those new positions. So that's not a problem.
So I see here heads nodding. So yeah, as a personal aside, when I applied for my CADE, I was still a fellow at the NIH. So I hadn't been onboarded at the VA when I applied. So that was a long time ago. So rules have changed. But any other comments on that?
And I also add, in some instances where the individual may have a dual appointment, it is often encouraged that they put the career development application in early as they come on board.
Good point. Thank you. Do we have time for one more question? Look like we have about 2 minutes left.
Yep, let's sneak in one more here. This looks like hopefully it won't be a long question. Can you clarify if an investigator can receive the equipment startup funds as was in the old merit award?
I can clarify that we eliminated the equipment funds. That would have to be taken out of the budget cap, or you'd have, if it's a particularly, you know, expensive and important piece of equipment, you might request a waiver of the budget cap in order to have specific funding for that equipment. I guess when I was an investigator, I always asked for the equipment money, but then I just used it for everything else. I never actually bought the equipment that I requested. So.
Now all the secrets come out. just so everybody knows, we do have several pending questions left here. I will get those downloaded and sent over to the panel, and we will get those answers out to the audience as quickly as we can.
I have one question before everybody goes away. Should we have another panel with the AMP directors? We only had the ability to have one because you just can't handle a big panel on this format. But put in the chat if you'd like us to have another webinar with a panel of AMP directors.
I'm getting a lot of yes, please.
Okay.
Like a lot.
Bad news, Ken.
At least you have company.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank all the panel members for helping out with this today. And we will follow up with the questions we couldn't get to. So thanks a lot.
Fantastic. Thank you, everyone. For the audience, when you log out, you will be prompted with a feedback form. Thank you, everyone, for taking a few moments to fill that out. And I will get these questions over to the panel as quickly as I can today. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we look forward to seeing you at a future session. Have a great day, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you. Bye.